The Ocelli Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ocelli.
December 7, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And you already hear the chair from my guest. So I bet you know who it is. Anyway, it's Woden's Day Wednesday. And yeah, I did not broadcast last night. And Monday, I did some recording for the book. But all of these things are in progress. Anyhow, I actually fell asleep at my desk last night and could not be woke up. That's about where we're at now. I've been sick lately. I've been trying to keep it to myself, but yeah, I'm just tired. Okay, so good luck energy wise tonight. Anyway, you heard the chair. And it's a Wednesday. You know, that's weird because I used to produce this show on the network here with this guy named Don Jeffries.
Same chair, too. Yeah.
Same chair, same guy. Don Jeffries is with me in the first hour. Second hour, J.G. Michael from Parallax Views Podcast will be with us. So anyway, that's the Wild Card Wednesday lineup in case you're tuning in live. And if you're not, you're hearing us further on down the stream. And I appreciate you. Anyway, about 4 minutes going late on the live thing. But again, podcast, you don't care. So anyway, America Unplugged over there, all that good stuff. And I'm going to clarify something with Don on air because people have been a little weird about, is there like a problem between you and John Jeffries? No, there's no problem as far as I'm concerned.
No. No. You know, I badmouth enough of these feuds and the JFK roots. I don't get into it. I have no problem, Chuck. Of course not. It's always glad to be on the Ocelli Effect.
And I appreciate you. Look, you know what? I have disagreements with Don. That's true. But they're practical disagreements. I mean, and that's it. But I didn't cancel his show because I hate Don. Or I didn't want to do, you know, it's like, oh, I don't think to do. It's just that I don't think it was a good thing for either one of us. I thought he was better off focused with what he was doing with Tony Arterburn over there because Tony had the ability to set him up with a website. This is the truth, by the way. This is exactly what I said to Don when I called him up one day and I said, Don, you know, I don't think I'm going to do your show anymore. It wasn't because I don't like the guy. It wasn't because I wasn't interested in his guests. Would I have brought everybody on the show that he brought on his show? No. But that's the thing. I don't control the hosts. I mean, Jack Blood pisses me off every other week. I gotta tell you. But I do his show. And anyway, thing is, that wasn't the problem. It just didn't seem to be the right place for him. I didn't think his people were coming over to the network. I didn't think we were doing a proper job getting him out there. Tony Arterburn was. So that's all there was to that, honestly. And that's what I told Don. Privately, yes. I said, Don, you know, I think this is better if you don't have this show here because it's just like it looks like an afterthought. It's not good. You know, yeah, and
we're all good. We're all good. It's no problems, Chuck. We're all good.
Yeah, I know we're good, but some people are like, oh, you guys must have some problem. No, I don't. I don't have any problem. I'm happy. I even showed up on a couple of shows with Don, didn't know he was going to be there. And it's like, hey, there's Don Jeffries. Great. I'm like, now, there are people that, you know, have given me problems in the past that have, you know, have picked issues with me and whatnot. But this wasn't like, oh, Don and Chuck hate each other. It was just the situation wasn't right. And you know what? I reserve the right if one day Don needs a producer for something. He might call on me if he wants some audio production. Who knows? We could work together in the future.
That's right. It is. What is the guy, the old, you know, I was writing on Borrowed Fame. There was a guy. Oh, God, I can't remember the guy's name now. Shit. But he was most famous. What was that guy's name? He basically used to fall asleep at the studio every day and they'd wake him up and he'd come up with these incredibly witty lines.
Yep.
And his best one was be nice to the people on the way up because you'll see the same people coming back down. So I've taken that advice to heart. So as we climb all around this alternative media poll, I try to be nice to people.
And there was one day, by the way, not recently, obviously, because we stopped doing the show a little while ago. There was one day I was totally asleep and slept through Don's start time one day.
I remember that.
That happened. I'm not usually irresponsible like that. So everybody got concerned like something happened to me because
I don't
usually. Chuck's pretty good about showing up when he's supposed to show up and doing what he, Yeah, there was that, and then of course there was the night that lightning was striking all over.
Oh,
me.
Oh yes, 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 yes.
It took me out. But yes. Other than, listen, acts of God, and one day I fell asleep. Other than that, I was more than happy to produce Don's show. Real proud of it. And the fact is, he's written one of the best books put out in the past 10 years, which to me is still Survival of the Richest. I know you have newer stuff, but I appreciate that book. I've told you that all along.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and look, I didn't change anything. Nothing changed. Anyway, let's catch up because I don't know all of what you're doing. I know somebody pointed me to a discussion you were having the other day. Here we go again, something I'm not too thrilled with. But somebody was very seriously going over Judy Baker's claims with you. And I'm going, ah, Don, why?
No, I don't remember. It was no, who was doing that? Nobody is. Who was ahead? I talked to so many people and I forget. And who was that? No, it was somebody was talking about. God, I can't believe I don't remember. Chuck, but it wasn't, the show wasn't about Judy Baker. But.
No, it wasn't. But the section I tuned into, it was like, well, Judy Baker says this, and Judy Baker says that. And it wasn't Don saying it; it was the other guy. And I'm going,
oh, no, yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to. I can't believe I don't remember who that was. Jeez. It's not a, but I am getting old, obviously. But no, but yeah, the whole point was, you know, how I mean, Judy's, but yeah, I think it's reflective of the research community that she's kind of becoming maybe the biggest name since Oliver Stone, blessed her. You know, lots of, and she's got, you know, she's got, I think she's still got Chris Milligan's all time best selling book somehow. I don't know how at Trine Day, but. People, for whatever reason, they want to believe, and yeah, I mean, I've always found lots of huge loopholes in her story, but I'm kind of, you know, again, I'll be nice to her when she contacts me. I'll be nice to her, but I'm not gonna. I've heard enough people that, you know, bought into her and she, you know, changed her story and stuff. But I do think that there's something. She had some kind of connection to Oswald because apparently she did work at the Riley Coffee Company. But beyond that, I have, you know, I know what I was arguing with somebody about. Maybe it was that interview. They were talking about pictures. And I said, well, you know, because somebody was, you know, I don't know, somebody was saying it was not, why aren't there any photos of her and Oswald together? And that was the way I defended her. I just said, well, you know, to be honest with you, you know, she was committing adultery. I mean, Oswald was cheating on his wife, if that was the case. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know about you, but if I was cheating on my wife, I don't think I'd, you know, want to have photos taken of the woman. So I can understand that. So for people to say there's no photographic record, but yeah, I'm aware of the holes in her story. I'm not going to go to the extent of Walt Brown and write a book, you know, refuting her, but, you know, I'm aware of it.
Yeah, no, and look, and I support Walt's book, but, yeah. You know, the thing is, I by the way, I agree with you there that, you know, for the people that want to say, well, you know, how many, and look, I've got plenty of people in my family who have had the girlfriend and the wife at the same time, and I got to tell you, and I'm not even saying that I am or am not one of those people, I do not confirm nor deny, folks, but I'm saying that I've seen the situation. And yes, indeed, there is a little bit of a compartmentalization where you might not keep photographs around of the mistress. I mean, yeah, that's true.
Exactly. Of course. Well, not it was Jack Roth. Jack Roth, because I had him on the show recently. He's and this is how you wonder why I couldn't remember the name. I couldn't remember my name because Jack had. He's got a new book out from Skyhorse about the JFK assassination, the millionth book about it. But so he's asked me, you know, can I come on your show? And I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, you know, can you send me a PDF of your book? So he said, sure. So I'm looking through it, and it's basically a bunch of interviews with people, and some of them are interesting because I hadn't heard of them before. But and there's not many I haven't heard of at this point. But I'm looking to see Vince Palorama's Amara's name. I see William Matson Law, and I'm thinking, what the hell didn't he interview me? So then I get done court, there's a chapter with me, and I said I don't even remember doing this, and here I was just kind of on the fence about it. I said, well, of course you can come on the show, you know. But he didn't have a chapter about Judith Baker, but I guess maybe I don't know that he believes or not, but I think that's what that had to be from that, because that's the only JFK guest I've had for a while.
Okay, good. You know, I actually recently encountered a guy who I think would be a great one. And there's the chair, folks.
Yeah, there's the chair.
Yeah, I always got to point that out because I kept trying to get Don to quiet down his chair, and he never did. So now the chair is a fan club over there on America Unplugged. Is it on America Unplugged or I Protest where the fan club?
Both of them, because they have watched it all the same. They're seriously talking about Tony's seriously talking about having products, and they're talking about having people are demanding have one for Don's chair, a t-shirt. So not for me, but for my chair. So this stupid chair gets more attention than I do.
I'll tell you what, if he makes one thing I do want from you then, okay? Because I know I didn't demand. I asked for a book a while ago, which Don graciously sent to me, signed book. I appreciate it. It's on my shelf. But you know, if there are t-shirts made for the chair, you guys got to give me one because I'm the first guy.
Sure. That's right. You pointed it out. Sure. Of course.
I'm the guy who originated the complaint, right?
We'll see if that ever gets off the ground. But I think when they look at the cost involved, they say, do we want to have a t-shirt about something this frivolous? You know,
I have seen people print and sell t-shirts over things much less significant than your chair. Okay. So why not?
Yeah.
Interesting. No, but I encountered a guy recently, actually, who I thought would be a good guest. Maybe you've already had him on one of your shows. Mark Shaw. You ever heard of him?
I have heard of him. I've stayed away from him because I love the Kilgallen stuff and I agree with him. But then he concludes that Oswald did it.
Hmm.
So, I mean, I think you seem like you wasted a lot. So I don't at this point, Chuck, I don't want to get into arguments with people about that level. You know, if you're still, because I mean, the guy did lots of great research on Dorothy Kilgallen. So how could he possibly still? I would ask him, well, who would murder her then? You think the What's My, somebody, some disgruntled panelist from What's My Line? I mean, what, you know, what, why would she been murdered? Oswald's family? I mean, that's just, so well, to me, like,
I would, yeah, that's why I would find that show interesting, though, Don, because all of this stuff, I know that you would agree with 90% of the stuff that he is passionately talking about with Dorothy Kilgallen. And yeah. I've told you with Kilgallen, I think it's interesting, but it doesn't rise to the level of it's significant. I don't think it's going to help us solve the case. Okay.
No.
I told you that. That's my opinion. Many people disagree with me, and that's fine. But you're interested in it. I know you are. And I know you would agree with a whole lot of the stuff that he claims he researched and interviewed people with and got information about this and that and inside. So I'm sitting there saying to myself, this guy's perfect for Don, except exactly what you just mentioned, yes. Which is at the end, it comes down to, well, if Oswald basically acted alone, and indeed you got some, and I couldn't quite get clear enough what the nefarious connection to Jack Ruby was, because if it is Lone Nut Oswald, okay, let's just go play devil's advocate for a moment. Neither one of you or I, just for the record, believe that for a second. No. But let's just say we did, for argument's sake. Then what would be the point of having a guy off him? Why?
Exactly.
Because the only explanation is, and the only logical thing, and I'm trying to be objective here, Don, you know this,
right?
Is that if the CIA was interacting with this guy and he went rogue and pulled this off of his own volition, then you need to cover up. Then you need to off him because you don't want him saying, listen, I was working for the CIA. You don't want that to come out in trial, et cetera. And maybe that would be a reason. But I haven't heard Shaw establish that. Now, I've heard other people say that, where, listen, it comes down to the guy's a lone nut and everything else. But because, and I don't know if you, the chair is getting upset. I don't know if you caught the recent press conference. I know I sent you a link. I sent everybody I could a link to it. You know, Jefferson Morley,
yes.
Mary Farrell Foundation, there is a lawsuit against the Biden administration currently to get them to, by the 15th, by the way, by next week as we speak, to actually follow through on a memo they issued saying that they were going to release the rest of these files that have been kicked down the road now since 2017,
right,
when they were supposed to be released. You know what I'm talking about, Don.
Right.
And it's interesting, sure. And I know that we check that out and we find that if you listen to Mr. Morley, and you know what, again, you can disagree with Jeff Morley on a bunch of things, but big problem trying to disagree with him about whether the CIA knew that Lee Harvey Oswald was around and that they had some fingers on him. Now, you want to get into exactly what they were using him for or what it was that they had interest in him for? There's a lot of debate. There's a lot of room. But I think it's difficult unless you are, you know, one of these Warren Commission acolytes, you know, or you know, you just want to believe that there's just lone nut, crazy kid Oswald. If you want to believe that, fine. Maybe you don't agree with this. But hard to argue if you think almost anything else that there is not evidence that the CIA had their hands on him one way or another. And we have documentation, as was shown during that presentation, to prove that there is definitely some interaction here. Now, do we know everything? No. But they're still withholding these documents. So let's see it. He's the lone nut, then fine. Explain the CIA's interaction with him. He's the lone nut, fine. Explain why Customs is interacting with him. He's exactly. He's an FBI informant. Maybe anybody could have back then. No problem. But explain this. Explain how J. Edgar Hoover drops the alert on him just before the assassination. That's true, by the way. There was an alert tagged to his name, like, and they were reading his mail. We know this now. Well, this is all true.
Hoover was asking questions about him, about somebody impersonating him in 1960.
Right.
So, I think this is great. Morley barely knows who I am, which is odd because we were on the same. My only network television show was on the Travel Channel's World's Most Unexplained a couple of years ago. Somehow they asked me, and Morley was one of the other. I think there were four of us. Morley was one of the other guys, and he also wrote a nice article when I happened to be at Tulsi Gabbard's rally a few years back here, and I got to ask her a question about, hey, I hear you're reading JFK and the Unspeakable. So he liked her, and we filmed her answer and put it online, and he kind of made it go as viral as anything for me could go, and so he wrote an article about it. But he seems to have forgotten me since then. But look, he's close to mainstream. He is mainstream, so I welcome anything he does in this. Certainly, if he can, I mean, there's so many reasons to know Oz. I mean, we had the testimony from the House Select Committee on assassinations. I forget the guy's name that testified about everybody. You know, everybody knew that Oswald was CIA and he was in the CIA. But we certainly know that Oswald had this 201 file. But anything that can add to that, you know, if he can get credibility, and who knows, maybe they'll start opening up about this like they have about UFOs for some bizarre reason after covering up for decades.
But maybe. And, you know, and painstakingly, John Newman, I know it's almost indecipherable to a lot of people, and his books are difficult to read. I mean, yeah. I love Newman's work, but hard read. It's a slog, okay? He's proven, as far as I'm concerned, that Oswald's 201 file is also strange. A personnel file to be developed by the CIA, again, it doesn't make you a CIA agent, okay?
Right.
Potentially, Don and I could have 201 files with the CIA, basically, because we could be people of interest at a certain point. And in point of fact, I know I have that version of it with the FBI because they told me. Anyway, I told you that story about when I got married and all that, and they showed up and Homeland Security was activated. It wasn't my fault. I didn't do anything. But anyway, they showed up and the end of that anecdote is I had armed FBI agents with snipers posted at my wedding. Anyways, that's true. But so for me to have a person of interest file would not be unusual. Now, what is in that file, who handles it, who actually controls it and contributes to it, that is a point of interest. Because if nobody in counterintelligence is interested in me, then they're not going to pick up my personnel file, okay? And yet, see, the 201 file, there's proof that there were people in counterintelligence signing out his 201 file. Now, that could be for a variety of reasons, but there is no explanation. So, yes, gaps. Let's fill them out. Let's get them. Let's see what the rest of this stuff. And, okay, back to the point, though. If you believe that Oswald alone did it, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, look, the moon is made of cheese. Fine. Okay, yeah. Dude, it's cool. Earth's flat. I got you. But please, if you're anywhere else, you're going to say there are questions here that need to be answered. We already have been waiting since 1992, when the JFK Records Act was first put into place. Let's get to it already.
Right.
And again, 25 years, yeah, That's what it took from the inception. 25-year gap. They were supposed to have time, sources and methods. And that's the other thing, is if you're protecting files on Oswald and you're saying it's because of sources and methods, then that obviously means he's either in touch with sources and methods or he is a source and method.
Right.
Okay. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's just me and the ignorance I have of the English language, Don, but it appears to me as though if that is part of your justification, and forget about this COVID justification that, you know, Biden, oh, by the way, COVID interfered.
Right.
Yeah. 60 years. I don't think so. Even Fauci's not going to tell you COVID's been around for 60 years. Okay.
Right.
You know, which, by the way, is really funny because you would have thought that I might have, you know, decided to cut your show loose because I talked about that earlier due to the fact that, you know, you went a little intense on the COVID thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm on your side, A. And B, even when YouTube was piling on, they only entered complaints about your show as an afterthought.
Right.
I had 5 strikes by the time on who did whole hours.
Yeah.
With people that they would have said were pushing medical misinformation. Whole hours I put up on YouTube of Don's show like that, they didn't take them down until after I had 5 strikes.
Okay. Well, they found me later over when I put, because I can't now when I live stream my protest. We live stream it because it gets a lot of people watching and commenting on YouTube. But and they got rid of my channel once, and I actually petitioned them, and they actually brought it back. But as long as I delete it right after the show, then it's fine. But if it stays up there, I'm going to instantly get a strike for some kind of misinformation every time.
Yeah, and me too. You know, they whacked me with all kinds of weird stuff. I told you.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing is, they didn't take me down for you either. So just to make another point, it's just that I didn't take down Don because of his material. And also, him and I are on the same side when it comes to the COVID thing. I was so happy when you had Dr. McCullough on. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Wow, this is thrilling. Great.
That was great. Yeah. And then, you know, we've had other shows. I'd like to get Scott Jensen back on after he shockingly enough lost the governor's race in Minnesota. I can't believe that happened. He was already on a couple times. I'd like to get his thoughts. But yeah, we're 2 years into this now. So it's pretty unbelievable. We're still talking about the same stuff, but I'm finishing up my book on the plandemic, tentatively titled Masking the Truth. And it's going to have all this stuff in it from the very beginning. I think people won't believe all the stuff that's been forgotten because, you know, just the way this went from point A to, you know, just from initially, and just people have forgotten a lot about it, but I call it the greatest psyop in the history of the world. And I think that's the only thing you can call it.
Are you going to at least give a minor synopsis to Anthony Fauci's history as far as HIV and all the?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we'll have it. I'm going to have more because I have Hidden History 3's done, too. That's with the publishers. Skyhorse, I don't know. They take forever to do anything over there, so they're mulling it over. Hopefully they'll publish it. But I have to give it to them first. But I have a lot about him and Hidden History 3, about his history with HIV, certainly in 86, and of course I have some in the pandemic book as well. But yeah, I mean, it's very important. He was very instrumental in getting that 1986 act passed that made it, you know, pretty much impossible for people to sue for damages with vaccines and made them above the law. And there's a reason why they did that is because they had a couple other vaccines at the time that had caused so many damaging side effects that parents were suing these companies left and right. And that's why they passed the act. Now imagine what you'd see now with what's going on with COVID. So yeah, Fauci was, and you know, we know how many thousands of people died from AIDS for the same kind of reason, because he was pushing the same kind of BS test with false positive rates, where people were coming to him with not to him, but where people were going to the doctor, especially gays. You know that they were all terrified. And so they all thought, well, somebody they had sex with had it. Well, I must have it too. So they'd run and get tested, even though they had no, oh, no, you're HIV positive. And then what do they do? You put them on AZT, which is like remdesivir and some of these other things that, it killed, I mean, that's when they got sick. And it was shockingly, when they stopped giving AIDS patients HIV, I mean, AZT, they stopped dying, amazingly enough. So, but now it's making a comeback somehow, Chuck, whether we hear that it's somehow associated with the vaccine. But you know, that guy's right in the middle of it. And he's one of the villains of our century.
Well, absolutely. I'll tell you something. I'm a little surprised considering that you had worked in the medical industry a bit. That was like your career, right? At a certain point.
Right.
You know, I'm a little surprised you haven't encountered a story like I'm about to tell you. I'm going to take a minute and a half to tell you a story from my life, which I have not related on this show or anywhere else. I'm probably going to put it in the book. But here's the thing. You know, working in medicine, right, you occasionally, whether you're a lab tech or a nurse or whatever, you'll occasionally get stuck with a needle that's been in somebody else's body. And it just so happens that me working convenience stores, which I used to do, ready for this, I got stuck with a needle taking out a bag of garbage one time. Okay, it was thrown in the bathroom garbage and I got stuck with it. And the protocol, corporate protocol, ExxonMobil, okay, was if that happens on the job, they wanted you tested immediately and they were going to pay the cost. And also, not only would you go get tested immediately, but, and this is in the 90s, by the way, this isn't even in the 80s during the panic. Mm-hmm. In the 90s, you would then get what they called a prophylactic retroviral medications. Okay. When you go and get tested because you were stuck on the job because they are now liable. You could be injured basically because you got HIV on the job.
Right.
Now, here's what I've never revealed anywhere. My first test was positive. And I was freaked out, you know, because quite frankly, I mean, look, I'd lived through that time. And let's be honest, if you were an adult during the time or you were a young person who might have been sexually active at the height of the AIDS panic, okay, even though, you know, you might have not likely been engaged in the exact high risk behaviors, you might have had a different mindset about this than people do today. Okay.
Sure.
Today there are TV commercials. Hey, listen, we got this thing we can give you and it'll keep you, you know, HIV free and you won't be able to spread it. I mean, every time I turn on, you know, between the Georgia campaign commercials this past couple of weeks and that, anytime I've been near a media device, I've been getting hit with that. But also they constantly hit me with, you know, you want to not spread your HIV? We got medicines for you. Okay. Anyways, so I go, I get my first test positive and I'm freaking out. And they wanted a second test because there was a preliminary test they did and then a more accurate test, allegedly, right? And it turns out, based on something I ate, this is a true story, based on something I ate, which was, I don't recall exactly, I think it was red meat, like a certain amount of red meat within the 24 hours before I went and got tested, you could test positive for eating too much red meat.
Wow.
Okay. So I go and I get the second test, which is supposed to be, you know, like the test, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, do your home pregnancy test. Now go to the doctor and confirm it. Like go to the doctor and confirm it. And I'm negative. And then I went and got tested again 6 months later, all at ExxonMobil's expense, by the way, because I wasn't paying for it. But they wanted to be sure that they weren't in some way liable, that I had not been injured on the job. And that's being stuck with, you know, some IV drug user's freaking needle that they threw in the garbage. All right. And that's not me working. And again, working in medicine, I've known lab technicians. I'm sure you've known lab technicians, Don. I mean, these guys get stuck right. All the time.
Sure.
Wearing gloves, whatever. I mean, indeed, they used to. And I don't know if they still do this in classes. But even when you're learning to be a lab tech or a phlebotomist or whatever, they have you practice on each other in these classes. They used to. I don't know if they still do. But I mean, you could literally be, if you're not using an absolutely factory sealed sanitary needle to begin with, you accidentally turn around and stick that needle from one to the other. You might have just shared blood. You might have just done that. I mean, anyway, all I'm saying is while working in the hospital, you're clearly dealing with sick people. You could expose yourself to everything from hepatitis to, you know, flesh eating bacteria to, oh God, what is the thing that like seems like everybody gets anymore? MRSA, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, so I don't get it. Like, how is it that we go from that to, you know, the great pandemic? And like, how is it that every health professional is not ill if it really was as advertised? I mean, there's a lot of open questions here, man. And I'm not even trying to say that I say that, it, you know, look, I believe it's a real thing. Some people say, no, it's completely fabricated. It's not real at all. And, you know, and again, we did in real time, the discussions about what happened to your brother. And I don't mean to pick in a scab here, but let's be honest. It's been a little while.
Yes.
You have to sit with it. And certainly they told you at a certain point that that's what contributed to his death. And I bet there's still open questions there. I mean, if there's,
yes,
I don't want to kick open the wrong thing here, but
no, I saw a couple, he can still have good guests on. Alex Jones had a couple a while back. He had a couple lawyers on there who were filed the first class action lawsuit for all the people, some of the people that, and the many, we don't even know how many, like my brother who were killed by the COVID protocol in the hospitals. And it almost brought me to tears listening to them because step by step, they described exactly what happened to him. I mean, this is a routine. Every time where they say you have COVID pneumonia, you go in there, no symptoms, say if you have COVID pneumonia, they immediately begin treatment, which is even though they didn't do remdesivir right away, I think, because I told them not to, but they put him on a BPAP machine, which is what they did with my brother. Then when they try to get it off, they put these big pads on their hands so they can't get it off. And eventually they tie their hands down. That's exactly what they did with him. And it's just step by step. And it was just chilling to listen to it because this is their protocol and they follow it. And they took lots of other people besides my brother, you know, from being not sick at all to dead in 2 weeks. I mean, that's just it's, you know, obviously you can't put a price tag on it. So I need to get those guys on my show if I can. But I mean, they've been on Alex Jones, so they probably not going to mess with small fry like me, but maybe if I let them know I have a personal stake in it, I don't know. But so yeah, I'm still very, and I'm not gonna let that drop, because especially when you hear more and more people who went to the, as I did at the time, I heard from so many people who went through the exact same situation. And I wrote an article on Substack, and if people want to check, I'm getting more and more subscribers at Substack. It's donaldjeffries.substack.com, and I call it I Protest, just like my show. Mm-hmm. And I wrote an article. You'd probably be interested. The last week, I think, it was called JFK, Thanksgiving, and My Brother's Downfall. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to realize that the two of the most important events that happened in my life, in my childhood, when I was 7 years old, happened the same day. I think I described that event with my brother, that it really led him down the path in high school, where he was dared to go pinch a girl on the ass, basically, who was a popular senior. He was a nerdy freshman, and some popular guys urged him to do it. And people can read. I mean, the world came down on him after that. I mean, he was expelled from school. He was prosecuted. I mean, I realize now that formed my perspective on life. At 7 years old, because I heard my alcoholic father constantly raging and bitter about the system and how the hell was he supposed to defend himself in court against a rich general? Mm-hmm. The girl was a general. And how, you know, that, and I realize now that's where my antipathy for the rich comes from. That's where my distrust of the legal system and the court system being rich, it comes from that, you know, being experienced. But this is the most amazing part. It took me a long time. I finally realized my brother's incident took place on November 22nd, 1963, the exact same day as the JFK assassination. So people can read it if they're interested. It just kind of goes over how that was, you know, my memory basically started. I mean, I had memories before that, but you know how when you reach a certain point and then your memories from then on, you pretty much remember everything. And mine was triggered pretty much by the JFK assassination. So from then on, so there are two of the most, you know, because that obviously, and I go into why that infected my life so much, because I in effect became the big brother, even though my brother was 8 years older than me. Mm-hmm. I pretty much became the big brother right after that. And
I think this also informed your attitude toward bullying. I mean, you did write the book Bullyocracy as well.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
And you certainly have taken the time to feature a lot of the situations where people are confronted by unfair amounts of force being wielded against them. And I think that was also informed by your brother's situation, who, again, you know, look, it's not as though he was particularly, you know, like a complete lost soul when it comes to being handicapped or whatever.
No.
Socially awkward might be an accurate thing to put on him. He clearly had some issues with anxiety and You know, again, I'm not trying to slap labels on the guy, but he wasn't fully, completely socially functional. And the fact is that today, I don't know if he would have been handled the same way over the pinching incident. But then again, it might be worse. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's what's so amazing. I mean, you're younger than me, but I mean, I remember in the day, it's like, you know, titty twisters were real popular. You know, you could go up to any girl and just do that. It's like, you know, like, and nothing happened to you. I mean, I think of it, it was pretty ridiculous to do. But, you know, I don't know. We just thought I didn't do it that often. But frankly, I was kind of scared to, you know, I wasn't going to go, you know, but, you know, go to the right, wrong girl, you know, because, you know, they have a sensitive area down there. They can quickly, you know, neutralize you. But
I wasn't the titty twister kind of guy either. But I'll tell you, you could get away with a lot of, you know, the girls who chase the boys on the playground and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, we did on occasion. I mean, I've talked about this a lot, that it was like my generation is pretty much the last one where, you know, we could beat each other with sticks and rocks and that would be considered normal a little bit among the boys. Okay.
Yes, exactly. Sure.
But among the girls, you know what? I remember the days of, like, say, you know, a 6 or 7 year old boy or girl, one or the other, and sometimes it was the girl being the aggressor, shoving a kid up against a fence and kissing him on the face or something like that, really to freak him out, and then he'd, you know, flip out. Oh, ew! I got germs on me.
Yeah,
this kind of thing, that was almost normal. And today, you know, 5, 6, 10 year old doesn't matter. They would be calling the cops.
Yeah,
sexual assault. It would
be.
You know, and meanwhile, this was the rough sort of, I mean, almost animalistic a little bit. But I mean, this is how socialization turns into normalization. And indeed, you know, you did get punched in the mouth by the bigger girl. Get a little embarrassed. The girl beat you up because she's bigger than you. I'm not saying this happened to me, but I saw it happen a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it was a different world. And so that's why, again, I'll never, unfortunately, and that's something I have to live with. Not only have to live with the way my brother died, but also have to live with the fact that I'll never get answers for that, because it took me a long time to realize how much, you know, it impacted my life. Even though it didn't happen to me, I was, you know, it changed our family dynamic and it changed him, because before that happened, I never thought there was anything, quote, wrong with my brother. He seemed pretty normal to me.
Right.
But after that day, I didn't doubt it for a second. And so it had a huge impact on me. But, you know, I'll never find out. And I tried, believe me. I contacted, you know, juvenile court records are either destroyed or they're sealed. And I had people that were real interested in it, that worked there and wanted to help, but they couldn't find anything. And he wasn't helpful when he was alive because he had suppressed so much of it.
Right.
And and now obviously you can't. So, but it is what it is, you know. And it's people might be interested in reading that. I got a lot of good response from it.
No, I know. And you know what? To me, this also lends itself to a larger issue of which, and I'm not trying to minimize what you're talking about with your brother at all. But the truth is that in a lot of circumstances, there are families that end up with a lot of open questions. I mean, during that same time period, I saw guys that were having a bit of trouble who were older. I interact with, as I've told you, on a personal level, I interact with a lot of guys who are Vietnam vets. It's one of those things I do. And some of them are getting to that point where, you know what, you want to call it dementia, you want to call it Alzheimer's, whatever. Mm-hmm. They're not fully mentally cognizant. And some of them went into hospitals and were put on respirators.
Yeah.
And I was amazed to see some of them even come home. But some of them didn't, too, you know. And that's the thing, is when you got people that are vulnerable for one reason or another. Okay, if there's any sort of cognitive dysfunction, whether it's age or it's damage or, you know, I don't know what your brother's story was. Let's just say maybe they would have put him on the autistic spectrum somewhere today.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But I think that's probably fair based on what you described. Mm-hmm. You know, but either way, I'm not saying it's right either. I'm just saying that's probably where he'd land. The thing is, when somebody is in the hands of, quite frankly, the medical industrial complex, and they have protocols in place, there are plenty of people that I think didn't need to die. I mean, if you take a look, I think that really, numerically, if you examine this properly, you'll find that it could be that our modern medicine has indeed killed more people than the modern wars.
Yeah, well, before they admitted that the the healthcare system itself, doctors and hospitals, were the third leading cause of death in America. That's bad enough. But I would submit that because they're not claiming they're all these died suddenly, all the deaths that obviously from the vaccines, they're not admitting that. So if you couple those in and deaths like my brother's, where they were killed by hospital protocol, not COVID, if you lump those all in, I think it's a certainty that right now our healthcare system is the number one killer in America. I don't have any doubt.
Yeah, but because they're supposed to be such a trusted, you know, it's the appeal to authority issue.
Right.
Where they're supposed to be trusted, right? Trust your doctor, trust the science, trust the, you know, and you know, this is what got me in trouble on YouTube and other platforms is, well, gee, I got questions here. And one of my biggest questions is, do you trust the companies that they're telling you to trust when it comes to this vaccine they want everybody to take? Forget about whether it works. Forget about whether it is a proper thing. Forget about what type of threat level you think that disease carries. Let's talk about people that are manufacturing this that you want me to submit to allow myself to be injected with. Now, are these not the same companies who have had to pay out billions of dollars for all sorts of wrongful deaths across the board? Every one of these companies, yes or no? So to me, that's a fair question, right? Can you trust the people that are telling you trust us now when they've already killed people and they've already been negligent and they've already gone and said, oops, you know, we didn't realize we're putting cancer causing stuff in talcum powder. Oops. We didn't realize it when we developed a better way to harvest, you know, because Johnson & Johnson, you're good friends of Johnson & Johnson.
Yes.
The baby shampoo people.
Yeah.
You know, they figured out a way to accelerate the opioid problem by making that friggin' straw that you could grind up the whole plant. You don't just have to score, you know, this is real opium, by the way. The poppy, you can use the whole plant because they developed opioid straw and they grow it in New Zealand. It's not even, you know, oh, they're getting it from Afghanistan. And no, they're not. It's in New Zealand. And they developed a whole agricultural system to accelerate that situation. I'm supposed to trust these guys.
Yeah, well, and how many people died from their talcum powder? And I've written about how I think they had to pay $100 million in damages for the talcum powder. Alex Jones is what, having to pay $1 billion? I mean, are we going to say that what Alex Jones did was 10 times worse than what Johnson & Johnson did? And I mean, it's unbelievable. But companies... And that's probably maybe one of the larger payouts, Johnson & Johnson. They certainly had other companies that had to pay something, but I don't know any of them were driven out of business. Johnson & Johnson, as you know, it obviously is doing a booming business with this killer vaccine.
Listen, they're fine. And you take a look, you start adding up all these class action lawsuits, all of these, you know what, we're not going to, you're not allowed to go in the media and say that you won, we're going to settle with you. All these things that they've done over the years, if you track it and you go through Pfizer, okay, you're good friends at Pfizer, you're good friends at Johnson & Johnson. And what was the other company that we were supposed to trust here in America, even though they had different ones in Europe?
Moderna?
Yeah. Now, you take a look at all their different products, okay, and all the lawsuits, and you start combining them. It's not hard to get to way over Alex Jones' numbers, by the way. Right. It's just that you got to combine this stuff. Okay, they killed this many people with, you know, the stuff for your joints. They killed this many people with the stuff, you know, the heart medicine that actually gave you heart attacks. They killed this. I mean, over and over again, you have, well, we put out something. The FDA approved it. Here it is. And people died. Sorry. If you survived or if you're a survivor of one of these people, by the way, call this law firm. You might get a piece of a settlement. You know, I mean, seriously. And I'm supposed to go, no, I trust them because they would never manufacture anything that would harm me. I think that's reasonable.
Yeah.
You know, a question to ask, but not on YouTube, it ain't. I'll tell you that.
No, you can't. Man. And that's, you know, people, there's the corruption is so deep. And that's why I'm looking at municipal corruption a lot. And just because I hear from people all the time that who are experiencing just corruption. Like I had a couple weeks ago, I had a woman who was part of the unfairly convicted group. You know, it's kind of like what do you call it? Project Innocence and things like that. That I keep trying to get those people on my show, and I guess they're too big. But she came on, and it's just one case of her son was obviously framed for murder. There's no question about it. But he's, you know, sitting in prison for the rest of his life. So I'm trying to go after people like that. There's a couple that contacted me. It would be on this week that whose children, and this happens all the time, children were taken by Child Protective Services and government, local government, because of their anti-vax views or something. I'm not even sure, but it happens all the time. And people don't realize how, even if we could somehow reform the federal government, which obviously we can't, but if we could, you've got all these other layers. I mean, there's people, and that's what really, it moves me so much to hear from these people, because nobody knows about them. But in their own lives, their entire life has been shattered. And again, probably I understand it because of what happened to my brother on a much smaller level, but it's that kind of thing. These things happen all the time because people abuse their power at every level, even down at those lowest levels.
Oh, yeah. And in some cases, you got, you know, listen, we're here to help. We're going to go for a welfare check. And the welfare check turns into, well, now we're in your life. And we're going to find that somebody is being abusive to an elderly person or whatever. And look, in cases where that's happening, you know, I feel good about it, where there is a situation where indeed there are people that are vulnerable, that are being preyed upon by their neighbors or their children or whatever else. And yeah, I like the idea that there's somebody to stand in the way. But here's the problem. When corruption is so evident in those agencies,
yeah,
the original intent turns into something else. I've told people several times, you know what, you are less of a threat to me if you point a gun at me than when you call one of these state agencies to invade your life.
That's right.
You know, you call the cops on me, I'm now much more threatened by that. You sent people with guns. Draw the gun on me yourself. We'll be less threatened by you.
There was a story the other day that again, and you know, the conspiracy world is never call the police. That's great advice. But it was a grandfather and the grandson were getting inside. Who knows what was, but they were in some kind of altercation. Sure. And I think one of them had a gun. So of course somebody makes the mistake of calling the cops. Mm-hmm. So what happens? The cops killed both of them. So, and that happens all the time. It's like, don't call the police. What are you doing it for?
Exactly. I am exactly that guy, though, who says, look, I don't. My one, I had a neighbor not too long ago say something, you know, because the police showed up at their house and this and that. And they were actually going around the neighborhood. Who called the cops? And I said, look, I'm going to tell you that you don't even need to ask me next time because I don't do that.
Right. No reason to. Yeah.
See, my house is the house that didn't call the cops. I promise you that. Okay. You know, and he looked at me and I said, no, I'm serious. That is I will not call them. If they show up, it ain't me who called them. I'm telling you, that's all there is to it. I don't judge anybody else. I'm not talking about anybody else. I'm just telling you, my home, we don't know how to call the police. Okay. Because we don't do it. I think you can dial 911, and I might, if I needed an ambulance, dial 911. I might. But then again, I had a bad experience with that last year, too. So, yeah. You know, and there's like no protection, by the way, for the patient in the state of Georgia. If you call the ambulance, I mean, unless they beat you up on the way to the hospital, you pretty much can't sue them. You know, lovely the way things are. But but I'd almost prefer that than having these people that, you know, all of a sudden can invade your life with five different government agencies, you know, send all of these allegedly well-meaning social workers into your situation who have no clue about what it is they're staring at. I mean, mm-hmm. I had a situation when I was getting divorced, right? And somebody called, you know, what we call them DIFAS in New Jersey, the Division of Youth and Family Services. So we call them DIFAS, but it's CPS. Okay, it's just Child Protective Services wherever you are, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so somebody called them in this, you know, middle of this dispute between me and my ex-wife. My ex-wife hated me. And believe me, I wasn't really in love with her no more neither. But you know what? The one thing that we were unified on is, you know what? You people need to get the hell out of our situation. Let us fight. Because this is not for you to be involved in. And the next thing I know is, even though they had no evidence, no proof of anything, they were like, well, you know what? We're going to recommend that you can't see your children, even though we just split up, right? Didn't even have, you don't have legal separation in New Jersey without domestic violence. So we didn't have a legal separation because there was no hit, you know, track record of domestic violence. But the thing is that it was like, well, we're going to now recommend that you go into a drug program. And now the funny thing is, at that time, Don, I mean, I'm not going to say that I have never done drugs in my life because that's a lie. But at that time, They had no cause for that. They had no evidence for that. I was not taking drugs. Yeah. It was like, how are you guys saying that? Like, what, where do you even get this from?
All they have to do is have a nosy neighbor. I know a poor woman who's all her kids were taken away from her just basically because someone tipped them and claimed they were growing marijuana and they're selling marijuana, which is ridiculous. They weren't doing that at all, but that was the tip. And they, I don't know what kind of investigation they do, but yeah, they just go on if the information is out and they, you know what the Georgia, in your state of Georgia, was it Beverly Schaefer, I think her name was probably murdered for her criticism of Child Protective Services, her and her husband.
Yeah.
Because there's so much of it tied to child sex trafficking too. We don't even know what they do with these kids.
Well, this was New Jersey at the time, but here's the funny part, right? Is that I said, look, you explain to me. I said, I'll go to your drug program if you can give me one reason why it is that you would even suspect I've got anything to do with drugs. Okay, just
right,
one.
Right.
And it was like, well, you know, when we knocked on your door the first time, you didn't answer very quickly. And I'm like, all right, so let me see if I got this straight. And I'm like 30 something years old. And I'm looking at this woman who's probably straight out of college, just got her, you know, master's in social work, right? Thinks she's, and you can be licensed as a psychotherapist in New Jersey if you have a master's in social work.
Right.
She thinks that she's done a psychological evaluation on me in 10 minutes and figures out that I must be doing drugs because I didn't answer the door quickly. You know, and I'm like, do you hear yourself speak? You know, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, you're 22,
yeah,
right, or 23. I'm 30 something. I'm not saying I'm your elder, but give me a break, child.
Right.
You know, right. I mean, you're only just graduated from college. You're making an evaluation on a grown person who is admittedly sleeping on his buddy's couch because I just got kicked out of my house. I'm getting a divorce. Okay. But I mean, you know, come on. What are you doing? Anyway. The point is that these people, whether they're well-meaning or not, okay, mm-hmm. whether they're well-meaning or they're trying to snatch your kids for their, you know, some nefarious purpose, they can do a variety of damage.
Yes.
And it is just outrageous to me that this is all going on. And even when I was looking at what's going on with, say, in New York right now, which this will be the final thing that I get to, because I'm not fearful, but I got to tell you, it does make you a little nervous when you start to see stuff like this pop up in New York, where, you know, Eric Adams, who is the new mayor there, he's the Democrat, former cop, police officer. Okay.
Right.
Anyway, he wants to empower the police more to be able to make these judgments. What we're going to do is we're going to have to contact a professional who might be able to do an evaluation. So what you're telling me is a cop who gets sent into a situation is going to call somebody on the phone that you deem to be an expert enough in mental health, make an evaluation. This is, and you want to encourage that?
Goodness knows the police have a track record for responsibility and great decision making. So
well, I'm sure they'll show restraint, discretion, and and be very fair about the way they represent themselves. Sure. In case nobody recognizes
they won't
that.
Be trigger happy or anything. No,
that's not called sarcasm or anything, is it? Yeah. Okay. Come on. I mean,
ridiculous.
Do you think that we're entering a time, though, that there is going to be more of this, let's empower the local authorities to be more intrusive, because I think they failed a bit when it comes to the COVID-1984 agenda. We do not have absolute compliance across the board. People got exhausted after being locked down and forced and this and that. And, oh, you can't do anything or have anything if you don't get a vaccine. You can't come to a concert, blah, blah, blah. Do you think that since people got tired of that on the national level, that they're not going to accelerate these things on the local level, and we're not going to see a lot more of these intrusive, you know, alleged good doers, you know, who might have, again, well-meaning intentions to begin with, but people that clearly don't understand their clientele, the people they're dealing with, the circumstances, or have the experience. Do you think that they're going to get weaponized against all of us, and we're going to see a time when on a local level, you're going to have to deal with more of these control mechanisms more than the great national level, which I think we actually averted in this country, although stay tuned, Australia, because, my God, all I hear from there is it's getting worse and worse from the national government. But I think our national government kind of failed. I mean, we accept that Grandpa Joe is there, I guess, at the moment, but nobody's taking orders from him nationally. Are they going to enforce this on a local level, do you think, Don?
Well, I think we already talk about the municipal corruption. It's already there. It's just whether it'll be more widespread to everyone. But right now, if you run afoul of them, as you say, when you run into people like you did who said you didn't answer your door fast enough, a lot of times that's enough to bring you under the umbrella of suspicion of something. I don't know what, but yeah, I think, and again, there's no fighting back. The Americans are just so apathetic, and you know, they ought to realize at this point that they can't vote themselves out of the way. Regardless of what you think of which Tweedledum or Tweedledee, who you wanted to win the election, the thing I look at is, again, how almost every incumbent got reelected. Do you know, for the first time since 1913, I think, or 1914, not a single United States senator that was an incumbent that ran for reelection lost. Right. So, I mean, and that's, you know, if you look at the, regardless of what your politics are, obviously America is in horrible shape. The economy is worse than I've ever seen it. And, you know, we're on the brink of World War III and all this kind of crazy stuff, allegedly. You'd think that would be a reason to have a bigger turnover. Instead, we had a less of a turnover than usual. So we have to hope that these votes aren't being counted honestly, because if they are, then there is no hope. If the people are actually can't stop themselves from voting these, you know, people like Scott Jensen, you had a great choice in Minnesota with a clear delineation, a medical doctor telling you, hey, this, I was ordered to put on death certificates COVID when it wasn't that. They ordered me to. And then you have, he's running against this guy, Tim Walz, who's one of the biggest. He's right up there with Gretchen Whitmer and Gavin Newsom, one of the biggest lockdown advocates. The people had a clear choice. And unfortunately, they made the wrong one if they really voted. So, yeah, I don't make any predictions, as you know. All I do is I say, whatever happens, it won't be for the good of most of the people. I think that, and that's just basically having lived my life. Whatever happens, it won't improve things. I think, you know, I don't know about you, but that's the way I've been viewing things, you know, during my entire life. Things happen, things don't get better.
Well, again, I'm going to give you guys the links to all of Don's stuff. I want you to go check out iProtest. Check out all the stuff that he does with Tony Arterburn over there, America Unplugged, iProtest. He has a Substack, which, again, you can subscribe to over there. He's got a free way to subscribe over there, but also you can support him if you like. How many dollars a month is that if you want to just support your work on Substack?
There are options. It's $5 a month, $50 a year. And I've actually had a handful of people that have taken the $200 lifetime membership, and they get a free signed copy of Bullyocracy if they do that. So I'm amazed at anybody else, because I don't put up a paywall. That's not me. I'm a populist. So you're getting the same thing. But if people want to, and some people have, you know, decided to help. And so every little bit helps. So, but you can certainly, free subscribers are welcome.
Well, right. And look, I'll close with this. I mean, and I urge you guys, go ahead and support Don's work. I highly recommend Survival of the Richest. If you don't own a copy of that one already, get it. When Hidden History 3 comes out, you're going to want to see it for sure. You know, we even got a little odd blurting out from Chris Graves on a show recently, talking about maybe something that might be in Hidden History 3 regarding John F. Kennedy Jr.'s death. Yes. Etc. But he didn't give specifics, but he gave enough of a tease there that there might be something interesting there in Hidden History 3. So there it is. Don Jeffries, as always, though, I do support Don's work. I endorse a lot of it. I wouldn't say, look, nobody's in a religious cult, okay? I don't agree with this guy 100%, and he doesn't agree with me 100%, but you know what? We do get along just fine. We are generally in the same direction when it comes to seeing the injustice on the planet and what's coming. But here's the thing. I'm not a prediction guy either, but I'll tell you, I feel as though 2023 is going to be a really interesting year. I think we're going to see a lot of changes. We're going to see a lot of new things come out where, you know, just like, look, this was the midterm where they didn't see the massive change. And I thought we were going to have a massive change because everybody does blame the economy on the Democrats. And yet they didn't remove too many of them. I mean, they removed a few from the House.
Yeah.
But the Senate did not change hands. It actually went, you know, complete status quo. Mm-hmm. And in general, you're talking about a very little turnover in the House during a time when everybody can agree that the economic situation, we're all getting squeezed hard.
Right.
So, it's weird that that happened. Now, did they count the votes right and all that? I don't know. You know, can they steal something from you that you didn't actually own in the first place? No. But, you know, here you go. I think 2023 is going to be a rocky year. It's going to be a year of change for sure. And look, they got to light a lot of fires in order to get us really blazed up for 2024 and the big show. So I figure that's the way that's got to go politically. Do you agree or disagree with my vague prediction there?
Well, I think, you know, what was it, 2020, when everybody said, oh, I can't wait for 2020 to end. This is the worst year ever. And then 2021, well, it's actually worse. 2022 has been even worse. So 2023, I mean, you'd think it couldn't help but be better. But, you know, I don't know. Things are easing up a bit. I don't see, you know, that many people with masks out anymore and everything. So, you know, I don't know, maybe. But then there could be World War III, you know, so it's like you never know what these people are going to do at any given minute. But and certainly the economy, I still have my real estate license, and the only part of the economy that was strong still was the housing industry. But now with this ridiculous rising interest rates, so they've killed that, too. So there's not a single part of the economy that is going strong, other than the artificially kind of keeping the stock market afloat. But you and I know that 90% of the stock markets, the stocks are owned by 10% of the people. So that doesn't even apply to most people. So, you know. But,
exactly. I mean, are you and I benefiting from the stock market doing well? No. So, you know, come on. Bottom line is, though, I'm not saying better or worse. I just think we're going to see a great deal of change.
Oh, it'll be interesting. Yeah, I agree with you there. It's going to be interesting, and we'll probably see. There's no question about that. I mean, whatever you want to say about the last few years, it's been interesting. Not from a good standpoint, but yeah, if this was a science fiction film, we'd be glued to our seats. It's just, unfortunately, we're starring in it.
Right. The day the Earth didn't stand still. How about that in 2023? Yeah. Don Jeffries, again, go over to all the links that I'm going to share with you guys. Check out his Substack, check out his books, and check out his shows, America Unplugged and I Protest, with Don Jeffries over there on the Arterburn Network. Also, he's on Rockfin and all that, too. So we'll give you all those links. Anyway, Don, thanks for coming on with me.
Thanks for having me, Chuck. Nice talking to you.
Excellent. In the next hour, we'll be talking to J.G. Michael from Parallax Views and also the other half of the Failed State Update. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect continues after this.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
Get ready for the Ocelli Effect.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect. A little bit late on the live stream, but that's okay. We might shorten it up just a touch and get everything in on time. And if you're hearing the podcast further on down the stream and all that good stuff, you don't care. So it is what it is. It's Wild Card Wednesday as I speak. So second half of the show. And a guy I haven't had on in a bit, J.G. Michael, Parallax Views. Of course, we'll give you the links to go over there. I think I always give you guys the Podbean link as well as his Twitter account. I urge you to follow his Twitter account because interesting things come out of there, not just announcements about upcoming podcasts and interviews and stuff like that and stuff that he's released. But also J.G. Michael says some interesting things on Twitter just in general. So I would say go follow his Twitter account to begin with. But also, if you don't know his show, what can I say? Gets incredible guests. Actually, I'm waiting on maybe doing an interview with one of the quirkier guests that I would not know how to get myself at all. but interesting, and I'm so happy that he's going to allow me to participate if he gets it done. One of the scream queens, if you will. Okay, my favorite, in fact. If you guys ever saw the movie Night of the Comet, if you remember the girl that ended up in the cheerleader outfit. Blonde hair and all that. Anyway, her name and everything is kind of irrelevant. If you saw that movie, you didn't care what her name was. It was that crazy movie where a bunch of people turned to dust on the night of the comet and all that. and then these two sisters end up in one place and all that. The younger sister, JG's going to interview soon in that movie. The actress, I should say.
Fingers crossed.
And she's got a new movie out and all that. And you know what? We're not going to promote it because I until we do the interview, let's not promote it, JG. But you have other stuff coming up. Interesting political guests, intellectual thinkers of all sorts, writers, journalists, very cool array of guests at Parallax Views. I'm always envious. Great stuff you do over there. So anyway, how you doing today? I know you've been busy all day, but how are you, sir?
I've been doing well. I had a lot of interviews I had to do today. I interviewed someone from the Cato Institute about arms sales. So I interviewed, you know, one of my libertarian contacts, in other words. And then, you know, I had interviews all throughout the day. I actually just wrapped up about an hour and a half ago with a really interesting filmmaker from Jordan, Doreen J. Salam, who she has a new movie out on Netflix, and it's getting a lot of backlash because it's a coming-of-age survival story about a young girl. It's based on a true story, too, by the way, about a young girl who survives the Nakba, or what's known in, you know, the Arab world as the Nakba, or the catastrophe, where a lot of Palestinians were, you know, forcibly expelled from the land. And it's a really interesting movie. It's currently streaming on Netflix. I didn't think I would get an interview with them because they're actually in L.A. right now submitting the film to the Academy for award season. But, you know, they made time to speak with me. And I'm really excited about releasing that interview because I know some of your listeners have differences with me on Israel-Palestine, but it's an issue that's near and dear to my heart. Just because of all my Palestinian friends I've made over the years and learning about the topic. But yeah, I'm trying to get Jefferson Morley back on to talk about the latest JFK news. I was unable to attend the Mary Farrell Foundation event, but lots of interesting things came out of that. Isn't that true?
Yeah, no, it definitely an interesting event. And they held a press event at the National Press Club on Tuesday regarding the enforcement of the JFK Records Act. And Morley would be a great guy to get, or Bill Simpich, who is the lead attorney. Actually, I'm trying to get Bill to come on the show Thursday to talk to me about it because he's the lead attorney in the case. They're suing the Biden administration right now. And there is a deadline for December 15th where, indeed, based on a memo, an order that Biden issued, we should see the release of all these files that were delayed in 2017 by the Trump administration, which, of course, were set to be released based on the work of the Assassination Records Review Board 25 years earlier. Yeah. So, you know, that's been my complaint for a long time. Nobody listens to me. But, you know, I've been saying all these people that said, oh, Trump is going to give transparency to all these. Yeah, he didn't do it with the JFK stuff. Oh, yeah, he did. No, he didn't. He acquiesced to a very general and improper request from the FBI and the CIA. Is right. What he did. And again, Morley and Simpich and these other guys have laid out the second attorney there, Larry Schnapp, also is an interesting guy, presented at Lancer this year about the progress made up to that point. And that was an interesting event for sure. And we should stay tuned on that. And we should stay, you know, tell these people, that, look, follow your own laws. You know, you're supposed to do stuff. Let's see it. I guess we'll see on the 15th if they actually follow through or not. But I plan to discuss it at length on Thursday. Morley would be good to have on, not only for that, but he's just, you know, an interesting kind of character, considering that he's sort of mainstream and sort of alternative as well, in a way.
Well, he worked at I remember I interviewed him one time, not even about JFK, but about Gary Webb. Because he actually made he was an editor at the Post, the Washington Post.
Right.
And he actually got the Washington Post, when he was editor, to release articles that were more supportive of Webb, or at least tried to point out where Webb got things right. He even published an op-ed by Ishmael Reed that was all about Gary Webb at the Washington Post. So He is a very interesting director. I should have mentioned, too, I think I let it slip my mind earlier. The name of the movie that that I was talking about earlier is called Farah, and it's on Netflix. I'm sorry that I'm going back to that, but I really want people to see it because, you know, I lived through the Bush years, so I have dealt with a lot of I've just seen a lot of bigotry towards Arab friends of mine over the years. So I think it's a movie that helps people have a better understanding. It's called Farah, but we'll get back to JFK now. Sorry.
No problem. You know, it's interesting when you got people that are associated with Netflix because it's very hit or miss for an independent content creator as far as getting them on a show or getting them to talk to you.
I've actually had a better time with not Netflix, but people who have made documentaries and movies for Netflix. I just had Miles Coleman on, who produced the docuseries FIFA Uncovered. And it was surprising. All I did was send a DM. I didn't have to go through Netflix. A lot of times Netflix is just distributing these movies. They're not like the production company or anything.
Right. Well, no, Tony Summers did that Marilyn Monroe thing last year, right?
And really? That was Tony's, the big Marilyn Monroe movie that came out?
Well, the tapes. Not.
Oh, okay.
The Marilyn Monroe tapes, where he had a bunch of interviews with a whole lot of people, and he's, you know, playing segments and quoting stuff from different people he interviewed. A lot of information there, and they did a whole series on it. But Tony's difficult to get a hold of, notoriously, anyway.
I have heard that. I've tried to get Tony on. It's funny because I'm sure a lot of people in the JFK assassination community are not big fans of Tony Summers. But he writes a lot of interesting material outside of the assassination. You know, I even think I know this will probably upset people, but I even think someone like Posner has written good books when he's not writing about JFK. I understand why you would feel differently about that. But Summers is an interesting guy. I found his J. Edgar Hoover book very interesting, although I sometimes wonder what he gets right and what he gets wrong and who his sources are. Some of the things that he's written about, I don't think can always be confirmed. He's a very interesting writer.
You know, he's a very interesting writer. And look, I've got objections to not only what he's written about the JFK case, but also when it comes to Posner, forget that. He has a book on the King case as well, you know. And yeah. I got to say, I don't know how much of Posner's work is actually Posner's. Okay, I'm sorry. It's just... I don't know.
It is interesting. You have to admit it is interesting that he helped. He apparently was friends with Len Kolodny, and was he helped with the Len Kolodny was doing, which is just kind of out there. I mean, I get it with regards to Posner and Tony Summers. There's some things in Tony Summers' J. Edgar Hoover book that I think he treats as completely proven that isn't. I mean, the questions of J. Edgar Hoover J. Edgar Hoover and the issue of like whether he was a cross dresser or not. I mean, there's stuff that Tony, I think, sometimes treats as more like absolutely provable. But it's interesting. Those guys have written. I thought Posner's Big Pharma book was actually really interesting and good, but. I get what you mean on the Kennedy assassination stuff. I know you've talked to people that are more skeptical about the, or I guess they don't believe there was a conspiracy with Kennedy, but they may have interesting views in other areas. Like Gus Russo, I think, has written some great books outside of the JFK assassination. I was curious what you think of this. Authors that may have the wrong views on Kennedy's. In your view, but they write about other topics as well, and maybe they're on to something with those topics?
Well, look, I mean, the most famous example I could give you would be Vince Bugliosi, who I think is, you know, first of all, again, another guy who I'm not sure about how much of his work he actually did on his own, you know, I question his entire thesis regarding the Manson case, honestly, especially when you take a look at all the stuff that O'Neill turned and dredged up and kept. And I look at O'Neill's personal file and the investigations that he did. digging into Bugliosi, just, you know, because he wrote that book about, you know, I think it's called Chaos or whatever. And it's wild, the stuff that Bugliosi was involved in. You know, he's supposed to be the squeaky clean prosecutor and all that. They sanitized him for, you know, public consumption nationally, I got to tell you. Because there is all sorts of court records where he's settling with, you know, the woman he threw down the steps that he was having an affair with, that he, you know, was trying to get an abortion, and all kinds of things like that. Okay. And clearly abused his position as a prosecutor before coming to national prominence. Okay. It's interesting, but Bugliosi, here we go. I can be objective and tell you that his prosecutorial brief against George W. Bush,
I knew you were going to say that.
It's pretty valid. You know, but then again, I could almost say with certainty that he did not do all of his own work when it came to reclaiming history. Okay.
You know, another person that's sort of like that, is, I know he poo-poos any like RFK assassination conspiracy theories, is like Dan Moldia. I think he's he poo-poos any conspiratorial view of the Kennedy assassination. But then you read a book of his, like, Dark Victory, about Reagan, the mob, and the MCA, and you're like, is this the same guy writing this?
Well, it's weird with Moldea because he is changed at a certain point. He was on the side of a lot of people thinking that there was, you know, certainly a conspiratorial aspect. It's not Sirhan Sirhan alone. Which, you know, we had that story has disappeared. You know, you want to talk about something that was an interesting political sort of scandal, if you will. I mean, they recommend this guy gets paroled, and the governor says, yeah, not with me signing off on it. It's not happening. You know,
I think Angela Berry's still working on his case, though, right? What do you know what happened with that?
I don't know what her status is. I know she did, but I don't know if she's still on it. And that's the thing about it, is that even when you got one of the guys that he allegedly shot in the head, and I'm fairly certain that he did, even one of those guys is saying, look, you know what? He's done enough time.
Well, not just enough time, but like I think Angela's argument for Sirhan is actually really compelling. She gets into the neuroscience research, which if you look at all the neuroscience right now, it does seem to indicate that, you know, by the time you're Sirhan's age, you're probably no longer a threat to society. Like levels of violence go down in men as they get older. So I always thought she was really compelling in making that argument. It's a very interesting case, regardless of what one thinks of Sirhan, to be honest.
Right. And I agree with that. And I am not one of these people that thinks he was firing blanks or any of that either. So I will go with the idea that maybe he had to serve time for the fact that several people were wounded, you know, and let's just assume that that gun was fired into the crowd and did strike some people. Now, did it fire the fatal shot to Robert F. Kennedy? I don't believe so. And I don't believe it's his gun. But let's just assume for a moment that we separate that and just talk about who he wounded and who he damn near killed. I think you could make the argument that, yeah, indeed, he's not a threat to society now because of his age, the amount of time he served. I mean, think about that. You know, this incident occurred in 68. He was taken into custody, and there he has been ever since. You know, I wasn't even born at the time this guy went into custody. So, you know, we're talking about more than half a century he's already sat in prison, and there's plenty of people for full-on murders, regardless of who it is. Multiple murders who have served their time already. Now, indeed, he might have been put to death, but was not because of the moratorium and all that. And I know that argument as well, you know. But at a certain point, I mean, what is the gain for keeping this guy in prison at this point? I don't know. So there's a lot of arguments to be made there, but I found it interesting that he got, you know, a parole recommendation, and then it was literally the governor of California who said, nope, no way, this is not going to happen, because he had to sign off on it, right? And so, you know, what else can you do at this point? That's gone very quiet, though. We don't hear from that. You know, Newsom said no. He's got the picture of RFK up in his office. That's that. So anyway, there's a lot to be said there. And as far as Anthony Summers goes, yeah, I know he takes very seriously and puts a lot of weight on a lot of anecdotal accounts that he was able to get from people. And in some cases, he got some unique accounts from people and doesn't always release his tapes. Now, that's the interesting thing about that Marilyn Monroe thing is that he's, you know, he's got all these tapes, and I know he has tons and tons of tapes, but unless you can actually call him in Ireland and get a hold of him, you're not going to usually get an interview with him, even if you try and arrange it through Netflix, I found out, or that production company that put it out.
I'll try to interview him about something, and he'll be like, I've moved on to a different topic. And even when I've disagreed with some of Summer's conclusions, at times, I go back and forth. There's even some of the stuff he says about Hoover that I think isn't as clear cut as he makes it out to be. I think it's still possible or even plausible at times. So he is an interesting author in that regard. You know, it's funny. I was just talking about the JFK assassination a week ago with some friends in a Zoom chat that I do, on like a weekend weekly. You know, we do it every Saturday. But it's funny because, there's so many different theories. One of my friends is a big proponent of the idea that it wasn't the CIA, but it was like right-wing birchers. So like the whole General Edwin Walker sort of angle. But it's interesting. The thing that gets me about all these assassinations, and I've always argued this with people, is that, regardless of what you think of the assassinations, I think the value of assassination researchers, even if you're like very mainstream, and I think I do have a foot in kind of being a little bit more mainstream in some ways. I don't always go as far off the beaten path as some other people in alternative media, maybe. But I think it's important what JFK assassination researchers often point towards. For me, Peter Dale Scott's work, the thing that has always fascinated me about his work is that he isn't just looking at the assassination, but he's almost looking at what could be called internecine warfare that goes on at a sort of subterranean level at all times in D.C. So, during Watergate, you have Nixon on one end, and then you have the Watergate scandal, but you also have, the family jewels being released with the CIA. So you have to wonder, are things being leaked by both sides to, counteract each other? With the Kennedy assassination, I think all the stuff that we've seen about, for instance, Jefferson Moreland and I recently talked about Richard Helms and how, Helms probably used the media to mislead Kennedy on certain issues. There's always this sort of subterranean, I think, political warfare going on between different factions of the DC establishment. And I think, in a weird way, regardless of what you think of the assassinations of the 60s, I think assassination researchers actually touch on that more than a lot of people in the mainstream or even, the alt media, just in general, the alt media. That's what I've always found interesting about the JFK assassination research community. I remember when I interviewed Douglas Horn about the ARB, the thing that fascinated me was, regardless of what you think of the Kennedy assassination, it was the ARB that found the Operation Northwoods documents, showing that there were, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were like, yeah, maybe we should do a false flag terror attack and then blame it on the Cubans. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the assassination itself, but, that does contribute to our understanding of how insane U.S. foreign policy was at the time. I think people overlook that too much.
I think they do, too, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, because this is one of the things that's often missed. So many people will refer to Northwoods but forget that was developed out of the Assassination Records Review Board.
Well, people always say, James Bamford revealed that in the puzzle. I think it was the book, The Puzzle Palace, about the NSA. But that's not true. I think even James Bamford will tell you that it came from the ARB. I think it's in one of his footnotes, but everyone forgets about it.
Yeah, of course they do. And that's the thing about it, is that not only do you get that, but you get, if you go for a deep dive into some of that documentation, and I've tried to cover it on this show and everybody goes, yawn, I'm falling asleep here. But some of these like paperclip type stuff that was revealed, which is not under Operation Paperclip, but, we're recruiting guys who are working, who are being evaluated by our national intelligence apparatus at the time, toward the close of World War II. And they were saying these guys are paranoid. There's obviously problems with them. And yet the OSS and then later the CIA recruits these guys for surveillance.
Well, not even just for like paperclip, right? There were other operations involving bringing over Nazis from the Third Reich. Like I think there was Operation Bloodstone. If people think it was all just Nazi scientists, it wasn't. It was bigger than that.
No, but that was my point, is that these guys are coming in. There's a whole bunch of intelligence assets that were gained. And it wasn't just, you know, the one guy who had the files and, you know, made the deal and, oh, okay, he became, you know, they always talk about the one guy. And it's like, you don't realize that there were a whole bunch of minor characters. When you start to go into these cryptonyms and you find out, you know, this guy's name was this, you know, I mean, they clearly talked about one of those things that was developed, you know, the code name of an operation during that press conference talking about AMSPEL, right? And AMSPEL was the whole thing about the anti-Castro Cubans and the DRE and, you know, in our relationship with those people at the time of the assassination and before it. You know, all of that stuff is, yes, it's linked to the assassination, but it lays out a whole other world of things that were going on that were happening in the covert world. I mean, today, you know, it's like, oh, it's a given that the U.S. government was involved in plots to try and kill Fidel Castro. But that wasn't a given in the 1960s. That was the secret operation, you know, the ZR rifle stuff and all that. All these things that have been incrementally revealed that give you a wide array of the goings on that are not directly necessarily linked to the assassination. I mean, tangentially, they are.
But well, even beyond that, I mean, like, I think a lot of the questions that arise from looking at just that whole history of, you know, covert operations and sort of the shadow world of the Cold War, I think a lot of it brings up very uncomfortable questions. Like I was discussing with a friend of mine yesterday the sort of post-war life of Otto Skorzeny, who, of course, was like a commando for Hitler. He was involved in the, you know, rescue mission to get Mussolini. But after the war, you know, he was involved in basically creating, you know, mercenary groups that would kill, you know, communists and Jewish people. And he was also involved in like arms smuggling on the side and whatnot. But it's very interesting because even I've talked to mainstream historians about Skorzeny. You know, the CIA and the Galen organization in Germany, they both knew he was, you know, abroad and they didn't really do anything to stop him. And in ways you have to wonder, it's like, well, did the CIA see some of these Nazi figures as being maybe useful to the anti-communist crusade that they were on? It seems pretty likely, but that raises really uncomfortable questions about, oh, you know, were we willing to work with these people just to defeat the Soviets?
Well, and again, if you read their own documentation, their own internal histories, even the thing that today, you know, I refer to as the assassination guide, which, you know, was written about, what, either Honduras or one of the other Central American nations. But either way, the blueprint is laid out there where they explain we're willing to hire anybody. You know, it doesn't matter that they're criminals. It doesn't matter that they're killers. It doesn't matter that they've been part of a genocide. If they're useful, we'll use them. I mean, which totally explains they lay out right there, you know, organized crime figures are great, you know, because they're very useful and they're usually looking for money. So we can answer that issue, no problem. How do you buy allegiance? You buy the people that are selling it. I mean, it's very simple. You know, and then they talk about sacrificing people and how do you lay out a patsy and all these other things in a document that I love the one part where it basically says, you know, don't commit any of this kind of stuff to paper. And meanwhile, you're reading it because it was on an internal document they committed to paper. I love it. You know, it's amazing to me, the stuff that gets developed, though, because it becomes tangentially linked. And the entire world of, you know what, the enemy of my enemy is useful to me. And what's funny is when, and here's where we're going to hit a real hot topic, but, you know, what's going on in Ukraine and the interesting propaganda operation that is in play and what's really going on. And you and I have not discussed Ukraine, really, okay? But I find it fascinating that we have a very pro-Russian contingent in alt media, which is very predictable given the fact that, you know, RT was supposed to be a go-to, completely legitimate and much more honest source of media than anything we had in the West, right? That was the attitude for a long time. And by the way, that's not just among the right-wingers, but that was even a more left-wing alt media thing at one point. We have this very interesting adherence to Putin being like a hero type, right? And at the same time, you have the mainstream media, you know, seeking to garner sympathy for the Ukrainians that are there. And I find it interesting that people that would normally be supportive of the idea that anybody would fight for their home, regardless of what you think of them. I mean, unless they're Arabs. And Arabs are different, as you well know. If they're fighting for their home, they're no good because they're Muslims. But, you know, outside of that, anybody else who's fighting for their home, especially if they're you know, not very brown skin in general, are usually acceptable hero archetypes. And yet, not so much with the Ukrainians. You know, they're Nazis. They had all kinds of chemicals.
I was going to say about the... I mean, just for my... the reason I don't talk about Ukraine nearly as much is just because, I mean, it's so much of a hornet's nest at this point, and there isn't really any nuance in discussion. There isn't really... Like, for instance, you brought up the whole Ukraine and neo-Nazis thing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I have Ukrainian background, heritage, right? So I do get very concerned about things like... the legacy of Stepan Bandera and his followers. I think Stepan Bandera was a fascist. But the thing is, you know, people will say things like, you know, the government of Ukraine is neo-Nazi. And I'm like, well, you know, most of the far-right ultra-nationalism in Ukraine has generally come from Western Ukraine. And there's a number of people that have covered this, including people that get cited by the RT types. Lev Galinkin, who I've interviewed, who is, I believe he either came from Ukraine or he has a background in Ukraine and stayed there for periods of time. He'll talk about, you know, far-right elements in Western Ukraine, right? Patrick Coburn, who's been a longtime war journalist, will talk about that at times. But that's very different from saying Ukraine is just neo-Nazis. I mean, I think it's okay to be concerned about far-right movements too, even if they're small, right? Like, they can grow over time. And I think there's real concerns there. But I've always found it weird how there's no nuance in that discussion, you know, especially from, I guess, what could be called the Russian cheerleading side of it, where it's no, that all of Ukraine is neo-Nazi. And it's just gotten to the point where I just find it very hard to discuss these things because there's no adherence to the facts or, you know, I hate to say this, but... You know, no one actually like talks to the experts on these topics. You know, not that I'm for the cult of the expert, but I mean, if you're going to talk about these things, you shouldn't just read from whatever script you're getting from either the New York Times or RT. I mean, I think the New York Times has been pretty lame in its reporting at times recently. So, for instance, they just reported that Iran has shut down the morality police. Well, you know, that was a comment made off the cuff by an Iranian official. And all he was saying is we're not really enforcing, you know, the hijab law through the morality police right now. But the New York Times ran with that as, oh, there is no morality police. They're not even called the morality police in Iran. They're the guidance patrol. See, but the New York Times misreported that. And, you know, it's weird because I just don't see much difference at this point. Between most of the mainstream media and most of the alt media. I think it's kind of ridiculous. Everything just feels like a giant propaganda war. You know, I was discussing with someone recently the Qatar World Cup, right, with FIFA. You know, they're doing the World Cup now. And, you know, I think I don't want people to misinterpret this, but, you know, when Qatar gets upset about people criticizing them, part of the reason they're getting upset – and, you know, this is not to take away – I mean, there are real – the migrant labor abuses in Qatar are horrifying. It is true that Saudi Arabia and the UAE, who are both Gulf states that at times work with Qatar, right? They are involved in like massive information campaigns against Qatar. And there's a reason for that. The Saudis want you to focus on Qatar so you don't see their human rights abuses. And I'm sure the Qataris do that to the kingdom of Saudi Arabia as well. So what I'm saying is, when it comes to the World Cup, there's all kinds of covert information warfare going on. And it's not even necessarily anyone's lying, but you know, different countries want you to focus on the affairs of, you know, the opposing side and not look at their stuff. And that's not a defense of Qatar. What that's a defense of is looking at how all these different groups have different interests. I'm sure Ukraine has interests. Russia has its own interests. And you can't just take everything at face value. But that seems to be what people are doing. And they don't look at how, you know, pretty much every state is engaged in its own form of information warfare. And I find it bizarre that people don't even think about that.
Yeah, no, I do too. And I'll tell you, look, when it comes to the FIFA thing, Albert Lanier wanted to come on this show and talk about it recently, so I let him. But again, I don't claim to be an expert, but just peering behind the veil a little bit over there, how can you make excuses for the level of abuse that it would take to accomplish what they accomplished? They built, you know, effectively a city in the middle of nowhere out of nothing, with migrant workers living in deplorable conditions, okay? And some of them not getting paid very well, and some of them, you know, no passports, they can't move anywhere, they can't do anything, they're not getting paid in some cases. I mean, I don't know how anybody can see that as, well, gee, this is a great and wonderful, clean victory.
Real quick, I hope it... With what I said about the World Cup, I'm not defending Qatar, but I do think it's... I mean, you have to look at how information that's being leaked or talked about. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's amplified by different state actors. And Qatar does that to the Saudis and the UAE too. But even saying that, I think people misinterpret that as, oh, you're for this country, or you're for that country, when really I'm just trying to figure out, okay, who is pushing what propaganda where? And, you know, why are they pushing it? What are they trying to distract us from on their end? You know, and I just don't think people have good information awareness anymore.
No, that's true. And that is because of this, you know, look, and even in mainstream media, they're starting to recognize, it looks like to me, that, you know, people have gone into their own compartmentalized realities to such a degree that, you know, there cannot even be an agreement about factual information any longer. I mean, in other words, all of the propaganda and all of the different amplifications have succeeded in creating a nuance in reality that should not be there. I mean, can we not come to an agreement that, yeah, indeed, what Qatar is doing regarding the way it's treating its migrant people is absolutely abominable. It's horrific. And we could say that, but also take a look at the rest of what's going on. You know, it's like we can't even mutually agree on these things.
Yeah, but, I mean, for me, the thing that I try to, like, push when it comes to talking about the Gulf states is the best way to push back against any human rights abuses in any one of the Gulf states is to pretty much attack all of the Gulf states at once, because they're really all trying to keep you from focusing on, you know, like on their issues. And they want you to look at the other Gulf state, which I think you have to take those things into account. And we don't, you're right. We don't have like a really, we just don't even have an agreement on reality anymore. I think it's two things that are going on. I think people are extremely atomized. You know, I mean, I talk to, you know, younger people now that my brother's friends with, and I'm just like, yo, you guys are like really disconnected. And just, I don't want to sound like the old person, but you're like glued to your phones and you're kind of like I said, atomized. People are very atomized, and I think they're sheltered in a weird way, whether they're older or younger, right? And I think that's a very bad thing. I also think that, I mean, basically we're living in a country in which, you know, interest groups rule the roost, right? There isn't like a we the people or anything like that. There's competing interest groups that lobby for their interests. And, you know, they use propaganda to rally people to that cause. You know, I'm interviewing Ben Freeman of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft next week. He has a new brief out at the Quincy Institute about the Emirati lobby. And he basically has spent his whole career covering, you know, the different foreign interest lobbies in the U.S., many of which are not registered under FERA, even though they very arguably could be. But what's so strange is that we're really a country that's in a lot of ways controlled by, you know, different interest lobbies. And, you know, it's not about the American people. It's really about, you know, who has the most money to get their lobbies to win. You know, how do they win the congressman over? And it's led to, I think, a very polarized environment.
Well, and that's the thing. Every single debatable issue, like if there's a criminal act committed by somebody in a prominent position, right? You're confronted then with, okay, so the court system is illegitimate. And you know that, Chuck, right? Because, yeah, okay, I do. But then again, you know, the idea that there is 100%, it's sort of like, look, if CNN reported it, it's got to be false. Not necessarily. Although I will say it struck me, that whole thing about the morality police being canceled there for a moment, a whole lot of other outlets ran with it after the New York Times published it. And I found it fascinating that there was no evidence to back it up outside of this one comment from one official. And I'm saying to myself, how is it that you realize that, you know, under the Iranian constitution, which, by the way, they have one, you know, that there is an Islamic council which must approve of all the other, you know, supposedly secular government actions, etc. How is it that you guys think that the morality police was simply canceled? Like, that would require, if you take a look at their system, I mean, assuming that they operate under their constitution still, which I think they do, there's a bunch of things that would have to happen, a bunch of things that would be noticeable that you could have reported on incrementally. Now, I'm not even saying that I fully comprehend all of the functions of government in Iran. But I knew better than they just canceled this morality police. And as you accurately stated, that's not what they call it there. Okay. but either way, how is it that we get to that point where the paper of record, you know, they used to call the New York Times, how is it that we get to that point where they drop something, nobody bothers to check it, it just gets parroted through various digital and electronic media outlets who almost, some of them don't even mention the New York Times reported this. They just report it as if it's fact. And then wonder why it is there are people that are claiming that everything they report is inaccurate, which is never 100% true. I mean, you can't sell complete fiction. You have to give people some demonstrable, you know, evidence for it, whether it's a piece of film, even if you manipulate it or describe it differently than what it is they're actually seeing on the screen. You have to have something to back up usually. But I note that on the one hand, the people that automatically dismiss anything MSNBC says is a lie, anything CNN says is a lie, anything Fox News says is a lie because of their political stripe, they're just as at fault as these people that take it all as gospel. And the idea that nobody bothers to go and check this stuff, and a lot of it gets parroted one way or another. Guess what? Your alleged alt media is also not immune from this problem, right? Because they'll turn around and parrot things and also mischaracterize things, claim to be in opposition of it. And yet philosophically it makes zero sense. Again, I find it interesting that, you know, this Stuart Rhodes story, right? Which is the last thing I'm going to ask you to comment about.
I have not been following it as closely as I should. But.
Okay, I saved the best for last, though, because regardless of whether you followed it or not, I mean, you know that he was, convicted, right? You know, in the January 6th thing. And, of course, the MSM immediately ran with he could get up to 60 years, which there was no way he's going to serve a 60-year sentence on this, okay? But either way, you know who Stuart Rhodes is. You know who the Oath Keepers are. And you know what their involvement is alleged to have been in the January 6th situation, whatever it is you want to call it. There is a primary example of how atomized, as you said, It seems as though everyone in the English-speaking world is, especially in this part of the English-speaking world, this place we used to call America, JG, okay, where we do not have a unified culture, no matter what people say about the agreement of the American culture and da-da-da-da-da, all that nonsense, it's not true. It never was, and it certainly is so self-evident at this point.
I would say it may not have ever been, but I think it's getting progressively worse and worse.
Yeah, I would agree. I tend to agree. But the Stuart Rhodes story is interesting because the same people that are screaming that, these people that have been held in prison, which, by the way, I love this. They're political prisoners. They've been held there since, January of 2021. All right, first of all, most of them not held since the day of, but even if they were, I guess you're not familiar with the way the legal system works in this country, because I know plenty of people who sat in cells for a long time under lesser charges, without charges, because they simply couldn't figure a way to get themselves out of custody for things like domestic violence, gun possession, minor drug possession, or possession of cannabis even. I've known people that have sat in cells a lot longer than these people have, and they're not political prisoners per se. The people that are like that, what is the reaction of this Stuart Rhodes story? Well, it's interesting. Now, I never brought the guy on my show. I could have many times, probably should have at certain points. I never brought him on my show, and I'll tell you why. Because even though I appreciate the concept, and here's where I might depart from you just a touch, JG. I appreciate the concept that the Oath Keepers allegedly hold near and dear. I appreciate the concept. I really do. But I don't trust those that appear to be at the head of the organization, never did, especially Mr. Rhodes.
I was going to say, mm-hmm. I always found it interesting. I think there were there's a difference between the national leaders of the Oath Keepers and the regional groups, because there were regional Oath Keepers in Ferguson that actually were defending. They wanted to defend the protesters.
Correct.
In Ferguson over they didn't like the police, and the national level, they were like, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. So I do think it gets weirdly complicated at times.
It does. But but that's the thing, is that now you see this guy is being splashed out there as, look, here's a prominent leader of an anti-government organization who has now been convicted in the insurrection. And crickets, mostly, from the people who have been screaming about, well, these are political prisoners. They're being held there because they're on this side. I'm getting a headache from it already, JG. I'm just curious about if you have any thoughts on it or what. Maybe you've heard differently. Maybe you're observing something different from me. But, again, I know we're all compartmentalized, and you and I don't necessarily exist in the same compartments all the time. So, tell me, what is it that your thoughts are? I mean, again, you said you didn't follow it very closely, but Do you think that this is one of those things that...
I'll say this. I haven't heard people in the alt media talk about it, even the more libertarian or right-wing ends of alt media, which I do monitor from time to time, even though I disagree with a lot of people on the right. I don't know. It reminds me of, I've told right-wingers before, I'm like, you're all for, defending someone that you want to be a martyr up until they actually get arrested, and then you just forget about them. Like we saw with Ed and Elaine Brown, so many years ago. Everyone just forgot about that. There were people that made a whole career out of it, and then they just forgot those people existed. Yep. I think it's happened a lot of times. I think a lot of these cases get used to push a political agenda until the subject has been, sort of exhausted. One of the things that scares me now is I think Trump has sort of shot himself in the foot. Now, I could be wrong about that. I think a lot of people that have been figureheads in the MAGA movement are now turning towards Ron DeSantis. In a weird way, I'm probably more horrified of DeSantis than I ever was of Trump.
Really?
I find DeSantis horrifying. I think he pushes for a lot of the same things as Trump. I think he's even more hawkish than Trump in a lot of ways, which may sound strange, but I mean, this is a guy who's like, we should just force regime change in South American and Central American countries we don't like. But, you know, they're all mobilizing around DeSantis right now, even as we have stories coming out that, you know, according to Mansour Adafi, DeSantis was involved in torturing prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. Although I guess there's a lot of right wingers that would be okay with that.
That's the thing. Yeah. And I would have thought that, you know, people that once they discovered that DeSantis may indeed have been involved in covert operations might have been leery of him. And by the way, I am satisfied that he was. I don't speak to the specifics of what he was involved in, but I think he's involved in some stuff that he would, if he were questioned directly about, would have to state that that is classified material.
For me with DeSantis is, it's funny because I just don't see him as much different foreign policy wise from like a George W. Bush. And yet the people, a lot of right wingers that we both knew back in the day hated George W. Bush. Right. But I'm suspecting that we're going to see a lot of, I mean, like Alex Jones, I think, has spoken highly of Ron DeSantis, right? And it's like, weren't you the guy that opposed George W. Bush? I mean, we're sort of in a snake's pit of frauds, deceivers, and, you know, charlatans, grifters, people that say one thing and then, you know, speak out the other side of their mouth.
Organically, before I ask you to tell people where to go to check out your work, organically, you've actually struck on my last little thing I wanted you to comment about. And it's real simple. I find it fascinating, the defense of Alex Jones by a lot of people who are complaining, oh, how is he? They're suing him for nearly $1 billion. And first of all, I want people to understand that, you know, the lawsuits and on these losses and everything else, they can be absorbed by the organization that he fronts. Do you understand that? So it is not a matter of, oh, gee, you know, he's going to get put out of business with these massive lawsuits and blah, blah. And knowingly, by the way, the guy did not adequately attempt to defend himself. So right. I'm just saying.
I do want to comment on the Jones thing real quick.
Please do, because I find it fascinating. The people that have decided to still defend him and think that they're defending him as some arbiter of free speech, which is really, really weird to me. I'm sure he's going to get invited back onto Twitter soon and all that because, you know, Elon, and I didn't even bother to ask you about that. But
I don't think he's going back on Twitter.
I predict he will. I really do. I think he's going to get invited back on Twitter, even though
Elon just said that he was quoting Bible verses where he was basically implying that Alex Jones should be stoned to death. Elon Musk was tweeting things like that.
That would not be the strangest thing for Elon Musk to do since he's gone.
And then bring the guy back. Yeah, it wouldn't be that strange for him. But I will say this about Alex Jones.
Yes.
I this is not a defense of Jones in any way. I think Jones, especially around 2016, he sort of cast his lot. And, people like Kurt Nimmo, who used to work for him, we'll talk about this. Nimmo, I think, ran the Another Day in the Empire blog. Then he got involved with InfoWars, ran it from like 2008 to 2016. You know, once Jones got in with Roger Stone and the whole Trump thing, you know, you could see a very discernible change in Jones. I mean, Jones always had, you know, an element to him that I always found kind of made me queasy. But by the time you get to 2016, you know, I think that got to the next level. I do think in some ways that the focus on Jones and Sandy Hook has let other people off the hook, but that's in part because, you know, some of the other people that push Sandy Hook conspiracy theories just don't have the same level of media attention as Alex Jones. But I think there's people that were even worse on the Sandy Hook stuff than Jones.
Oh, absolutely.
And I just want to, at this point, say, I know I can't swear on your show, but screw you, Jim Fetzer, you horrible dog crap human being.
Well, actually, since I've been canceled off of AM and FM, I don't really care if you swear now.
Fetzer.
So that's a big F you for Mr. Fetzer there. And he got sued too. I covered that trial. I had a correspondent in the room as he was being sued. Yeah, thanks again to Ace, by the way, for being there and reporting on that. I found it interesting. A guy who, you know, allegedly has a degree in logic and all that can't figure out you're not allowed to enter certain things into evidence, and you might want to follow the court's directions.
I was going to say real quick, too, you know, the other thing I've always thought about Jones, and you may disagree with me on this, but, you know, I've always thought Jones is just a very I think he's a very vice-prone person. I mean, I've seen streams. He did a stream with Paul Joseph Watson where he was saying goodbye to Paul Joseph Watson because Watson was starting his own website. And, you know, he was completely drunk and on pills. Mm-hmm. And his so-called friends and employees, Owen Schroyer and Paul Joseph Watson, were literally just laughing at him and, like, egging him on while he was completely sloshed and just talking very depressed about how he hates life and all this other stuff. And they didn't stop the broadcast. You would think if they cared about the guy, they would stop the broadcast. They really didn't. And like, part of me, this is not a defense of Alex Jones, but I think he's a very just vice-addled person that also is like very easily manipulated because he has a huge, giant ego. And I think people like Roger Stone got in his head, and I think he likes money. And, you know, I don't think he's like this master operator in the way some people think. Like when it comes to his little alt media empire, I think he's just an easily swayed. I think he's a useful idiot to a lot of different groups of people.
Yes, fair enough. No, look, fair enough. And the truth is, I've gotten plenty of inside information about, you know, from people that worked there or with him about, you know, various things. Is he vice driven? I do not disagree with you at all. but also, he's a very vicious guy when it comes to business. Extremely vindictive and harsh to
those. I was going to say he is a snake oil salesman.
And a snake oil. Look, multiple things can be true at once. He is a snake oil salesman. He has done quite well to sell himself as some sort of alternative, you know, to the information stream. And then, you know, pretty much sell himself as a libertarian, despite, you know, having extreme, very classic sort of right wing leanings.
I mean, he's basically a refried John Bircher.
Yeah, pretty much.
Did you by chance get to see his little interview with that warm Nick Fuentes and the artist formerly known as Kanye West?
The one with the mask?
Yeah, I'm sorry, but, you know, that was horrible to watch. And to be honest with you, this whole Kanye West thing, before we close out, I swear to God, I feel like I'm watching a real-life version of the 1970s movie Network. Just seems like everyone's exploiting a guy with a messianic complex. I mean, I also think Kanye knows what he's doing in some ways, but it all just comes off as really gross and exploitative on all ends. But I have to admit, when I watched that interview, I did laugh because Alex is like, well, you know, the thing is, my grandfather fought the Nazis and Hitler, and, you know, the Nazis weren't good, and the eugenics movement came from the progressives, and that's where Hitler took it from. And then you just hear Kanye say, I love Hitler. Like, I see. Alex didn't know what to do.
Yeah, he had no idea.
He's like, oh, I'm screwed now.
He has no idea what to do. It's very funny in that way. But I will say, and I stick by this, by the way, even though some people disagreed with me, I still have to say that that's allegedly Kanye West, because something is very weird in his speech pattern there, and I'm not clear that that's him. He's wearing a mask. Why would you do that? I'm having trouble following the reasoning here. Again, maybe.
Do you think his other interviews were fake, though?
No, I don't. Okay. But that one was very weird because it some of the stuff, and it's so funny. I don't know if you're exactly right because Jones doesn't know what to do, but it almost smacked to me of something that was not even the interview. Like, in other words, maybe it was edited together later almost. Like, the responses, if you take away the visual, you would think somebody had screwed with that tape. Sound-wise, I don't understand. There's something very weird with his voice. I have no clue why you would wear a mask. And the way he's answering the stuff that Jones is saying, I mean, it's almost like, are his headphones working? I don't get it. I don't get it.
I don't get it at all either. I mean, it's very bizarre. And I know we're running past the hour here, but it's just this is such a bizarre development. The whole Kanye thing now is just, I mean, right before he did the Alex Jones show, he had that falling out with Milo and fired him.
Yeah.
It's all very weird. You know, in a way, I'm so glad you didn't bring up the Kanye thing. I know I brought it up here at the end, right. But it's so interesting to me because Kanye has sort of spelled it out for people. He sort of said pretty openly, he's like, well, the more they cancel me, the more I become a vessel for this movement, which I think, you know, the movement he's referring to is like this sort of vicious, like Hitler-loving, like anti-Jewish stuff. But it's weird because even though he has said the most deranged things possible, people mm-hmm. keep giving him attention. And it's funny because, you know what? He understands how brands work. He's like, the more people talk about it, even if it's all negative, the more he can, you know, get his brand out there and push these sort of ideas. Because exactly. He has an even bigger megaphone than anyone like Alex Jones or anyone associated with Jones.
And he hasn't actually been canceled. And thankfully, neither has Parallax Views. JG Michael, I'm going to give everybody the links. We're going to get out of here, but I'm glad we saved Kanye or Ye or Yay to the last part too, because
respect his pronouns.
Respect the pronoun. JG Michael, in the first hour we talked to Don Jeffries, and both conversations were of interest. So hope you guys enjoyed this Wild Card Wednesday. I am Merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Go check out Parallax Views. I'll give you the links in the show description. Take care.